Liz Ellis is one of our sporting greats. She played for Australia a record-breaking 122 times, and she captained the national netball team for 4 years. She also won 3 World Championships and 2 Commonwealth Games gold medals. In 2007, just 2 days after leading Australia to victory against New Zealand in the World Championships, Liz announced her retirement from netball. Whether she's on the court or off, Liz isn't known for keeping quiet. Yet when she and her husband faced infertility, Liz did keep that pretty much to herself. For 5 years, she struggled to find information that she could trust about what was happening to her, what she could do about it, and what was out of her hands. After having her second, longed-for baby, Liz sat down and wrote a guidebook to tackling infertility. It's called If at First You Don't Conceive. I spoke to Liz Ellis in front of an audience at the Wheeler Centre in Melbourne. Hi, Liz.
Hi, Sarah.
I want to start with your own childhood. What sort of family did you grow up in?
Working class is the best way to describe it. There was mum and dad and myself and my little sister, who is now bigger than me, which is unfortunate, but she wins, I guess, in that ultimate battle. And we grew up very happy in Western Sydney and played in our big backyard. Mum and dad worked really hard and saved really hard. So every year we had a holiday in the caravan. They packed us up and we spent many an hour whinging in the back seat about whether we were there yet or not. And it was when I look back, and I try not to look back on it too much with rose-coloured glasses, but it was a very idyllic childhood, you know. I had a best friend in my sister who I could play with. I had great parents who instilled in us a great sense of curiosity about the world. Dad was always adamant that we would get further educated than he and Mum ever did. He left school in year 8 and Mum left school in year 9. Both did very manual jobs, but I feel with my father he was very, underutilised. He was an incredibly intelligent man, very a skilled artist, a skilled artisan. A lot of the furniture in my house he actually made. But he never had the confidence in himself to follow his dreams.
He used to be a stock car driver.
He was a stock car driver. His nickname was Wrecker. He was the Australian stock car champion, actually, for a number of years and used to race at Sydney Showground. And his nickname was Wrecker. And at a stock car reunion several years ago, one of his former driving colleague, but probably someone who he wrecked, made the comment that I played netball like he drove cars. And I took it as a compliment. But Dad's got great stories of one night. He used to have this roll bar and he used to position it so he could flip other people's cars. And one night he flipped this man's car and this man's mother at Sydney Showground, this is in the 1950s, chased him with an umbrella and beat the living daylights out of him. So no one's mum ever chased me or beat me, although I suspect there might be a few goal shooters who their mums might have liked to have done that.
Tell me about the similarity between your dad's shed and your kitchen.
Dad was very, very organised, and I am exactly the same. And we joke in our family that the older I get, the more like him I'm becoming. I look like him, and in fact, I look like my dad in drag. So,
gorgeous drag.
Not that I ever saw him in drag, let's make that very clear. But he, in his shed, there was a place for everything. And when we built our dream home about 6 years ago, in my kitchen, because I love to cook, there is a place for everything. The Tupperware drawer is probably a good litmus test. There is a place for the lids, there is a place for the Tupperware, and I get very cross if they cross over.
My Tupperware drawer would probably send you into cardiac arrest.
I've got my spice rack lined up in alphabetical order. Is that odd? No.
Your mum was a netballer, so is she the one who encouraged you to take up the sport?
No, not really, actually. She was quite a good netballer. She played locally at Hawkesbury at Windsor, where I grew up. But when the time came, I guess, for me to be old enough to want to play netball, she couldn't see it in me. And one of her friends, Sheila, called up and asked Mum if I would like to play netball. She was putting a team together for the Green Hills under-8s team or something like that, and Mum said no. No, Liz is a bit uncoordinated. a bit studious, likes her books, I don't think team sport is for her. So Sheila, great role model, a woman who wouldn't take no for an answer, rang Mum back about a week later and said, Margaret, you won't believe it, but did you know that I've just seen on television that 98% of kids who end up as juvenile delinquents in homes have never played team sport? And whether that was the case or not, I don't know. But it was like a light bulb moment for Mum. And she, and as it turned out, the week before I had tried to set fire to my bed. And so Mum was a bit like, yep, she can play.
I love that idea of Sheila spending the week trying to work out what's the best way to convince.
Yeah, and I don't know if she had
I know.
I don't know if she had a direct line to my parents when they found out that I was a pyromaniac, but anyway, it seemed to have worked.
It's good to know that's what saved you from teenage delinquency,
was
netball. So did you shine in it straight away, Liz?
No, not really. I loved it. I was very passionate about it. From the first second I stepped on court, I absolutely loved it and was very tried really hard but spent a lot of time on my butt. But over the course of the years, I got better and better and got to the point where, in fact, I could pass and catch and I could do what I had to do.
And what kept you playing if you weren't immediately successful with it? What did you love that wanted you to keep going?
I love the team aspect of it. I love the fact that netball really is the ultimate team sport. It's a sport that that not one person can dominate. So everyone has a role to play. I think it's the sort of sport that teaches kids cooperation, teamwork, all that sort of stuff that perhaps other sports can teach you, but I think netball does it so well.
How competitive were you as a kid?
I was more competitive than skillful, actually. I competed and I worked really hard and went really hard for the ball. And, you know, when I started to play reps, I played for a team in the western suburbs for Hawkesbury and we had a rep carnival. And I remember this distinctly because Manly were the team to beat at this carnival, and anyone who I guess grew up in Sydney or around that time would remember Manly as being regarded in rugby league, I guess, as the Silver Tails, and in netball it was very similar. And the Manly officials wanted me taken from the court because I bared my teeth when I was going for the ball. Let me assure you, by the end of my career, that was the least of my crimes. So,
did you win? Do you remember in that game?
No, I don't think Manly? We did. I think we used to get flogged by Manly a lot.
even more reason for teeth bearing then.
Yes.
As a kid, how conscious were you of your body and what it could do? Were you physical in your body in that way?
Very much so. And I've got great memories of racing against Dad, and he never used to let me beat him. He wouldn't let up and give me a win. So but the day that I actually beat him, it was quite a moment. And we used to spend our lives jumping on the trampoline, climbing trees. Our house backed onto a laneway and there was the neighbourhood kids used to play, and we used to make billy carts and crash them in the laneway. So we would spend hours and hours on it. I remember jumping on the trampoline for a full day and like that was it, that was our day. So we were so physical and our bodies were all about what they could do. And Mum and Dad worked really hard to sort of develop that in us. We never talked about how our bodies looked. It was all about what they could do, how fast you could run, how high you could jump.
Was there a point when netball started getting more serious and it started taking over the other parts of your life that you loved, like books?
Yeah, although I sort of didn't see it, but I started to make rep teams, and Mum and Dad, I guess they're the perfect sporting parents because they are the antithesis of the pushy parent. I used to get selected for rep teams and I'd come home and tell them and they'd be like, oh, really? Oh, oh, we didn't think you were that good. Well, do you want to do it? And so that was all. They supported me. They got me out of bed at 6 o'clock on a Sunday morning to get me ready to go to a carnival, to get on the bus, to be up at the netball courts to go, but never really pushed. But then as I got a bit older, as we got sort of I got to high school and things like that, and I sort of had to start making decisions, then netball really was a priority, but it competed with but never took over from education, because in our family, education was king. For Mum and Dad, that was a way for their kids to have a better life and to not do, you know, Dad worked in a timber mill and Mum worked at the local council and they wanted better for us. So netball was important, but it was never allowed to take over.
How did you meet your husband, Matthew?
He and I were trying to keep kids apart at a camp.
What do you mean?
Well, we were both working up at the University of New England. They used to have these summer camps and I was coaching netball and he was coaching rugby union. And at night, the coaches would go out patrolling to make sure that there was no fraternisation. So anyway, we got to the point, if you can't beat them, join them. So we gave up. And no, but the first year I met him up there, he asked me out, and I was still at the AOS. I was between in the middle of my 2-year scholarship, and I said no. And I don't. I said, give me your phone number. And then I got home and threw it in the bin. I wasn't that interested because I thought he was just a footy player. And then the next year I went back and he said to me, what are the odds at the start of the week? What are the odds of me getting your phone number? And I said, oh, 10,000 to one. Anyway, I still owe him that $10,000. So we exchanged phone numbers and he took me on our first date, which has become a bit of a folklore. He didn't have a job at the time and I was at university, so we were impoverished, but that didn't stop him. He said, can you meet me at Circular Quay, which I did. And I still wasn't that sure of him. I wasn't that impressed by him. So I met him at Circular Quay and we got in a cab and went round to Rose Bay. And he said, oh, let's get out and go for a walk. And I'm like, God, this guy's a dork. Like, we're going for a walk in Rose Bay. I'm wondering how I can get home. And we got out and we went for a wander. And then he said, okay, now it's time. And we walked down to the seaplane. I know, he had really maxed out the credit cards for this one because he had no cash. And we got on the seaplane and we flew up to Cottage Point Inn at Barrow Waters and had a beautiful lunch. And he was really impressed because I ate as much as he did. He knew we'd found the right girl for him. I went mouthful for mouthful. And we flew home and he'd organised a little water taxi to take us back to Manly and then this brought me back to earth. He borrowed his mate's ute. And as we walked out the door, his mate goes, ah, it goes like the clappers. And we went home. He dropped me home back to my parents. But it was pretty amazing. So it's been downhill since then, obviously.
You're both athletes. Are you competitive with one another?
Incredibly competitive. We play tennis against each other and it's like it's Wimbledon. And everything in our Scrabble is a fight, is a blood sport. Like everything in our house is a fight to the death. We've mellowed a bit since having kids, but not much.
When you were, when you had moved into this period as a professional netballer and you're also working as a solicitor, how did you fit both of those things into your day? How did the 24 hours allow both?
I didn't do it well, I'm prepared to admit now. You know, at the time I had no choice. Netball wasn't... it wasn't a paid profession. We trained like professionals, but we didn't get paid. So, you know, in my last year of playing netball, I earned $6,000 for the year. I had to do something. And I'd got my degree and I started working at Coors Chambers Westgarth in property and infrastructure. And I did the best that I could, but there were days where I would be exhausted and I never felt that I could give 100% to either. I would either have to leave work early to go to training so then I could give training 100% but my job, you know, the clients that I worked for would suffer. And then the flip side was if I stayed at work and finished off my work, then my training would suffer because I would be late and I would let the team down. So I had a 4-year period of feeling like I was never doing anything at 100%. And that, for someone like me, that's a really difficult thing to do.
But from the outside, it looks like you gave netball everything.
I did. And, you know, I used to get up at 4:30 in the morning to go and do a session before work, and I'd walk out of the door at 5:00 and look up and see stars and think to myself, what on earth am I doing? And it took me a long time to get to the point to realise that I couldn't be Superwoman, that I couldn't do it all. I did think that I could be Superwoman, I could captain Australia and I could make partner. And I mean, those two things are highly incompatible. If you drew a Venn diagram, they're not very close to each other. So, but it took me, you know, 4 or 5 years to figure that out and to have the confidence to decide, okay, I'm going to pursue my passion. I've done the hard yards with the law, but my passion is in netball. And it took me a little while to figure out how to turn that into a job.
How did you plan your retirement from playing netball?
It will come as no shock to anyone that I am a type A personality. You know, so I'd left the legal career behind and started running netball clinics and started picking up more media work. And so I had a nice career going, but I had got to the point I did my knee when I was 32 in a test match, and lots of people thought I would retire then, but I wasn't prepared to go out on those terms. I didn't want fate to dictate when I finished playing netball. So I decided to put everything into a comeback and see how I went. And that 6 months off was the best thing that ever happened in my career, because it freshened me up and allowed me to hit the last couple of years of my career with all the passion and enthusiasm that I'd probably had shined off me a little bit. So when the time came to retire, I knew it was time to retire. The year before I did, I was driving to training and not looking forward to it. I didn't want to do the drills. I didn't want to do the same thing that I've been doing for 18 years. And I thought, if I'm not enjoying it, if I'm not loving it, it's time to let it go. And I sort of had that feeling at the end of 2006, start of 2007. So I made the decision, and I made it at the start of the year, and there was a World Cup coming up at the end of the year. And I thought, I can't wait to see if we win the World Cup. I have to make the decision and plan for it. So I spoke to my agent and told her, and we just went through a process of, okay, what do you want to do? What do you want your career to look like in the next year, in 5 years, in 10 years? And I didn't want to go back to the law, but I love the media work that I was doing. So we just planned it. I sat on a couple of boards. I still wanted to do that. And the thing was, I didn't want to announce it until afterwards, because the two World Cups previously, both captains, Vicky Wilson and Cath Harvey-Williams, had announced their retirement in the lead-up, and both had spent the final quarter of their final match on the bench, and I didn't want that to be me. And we were coming into the World Cup. New Zealand were the world champions. They were the Commonwealth Games champions. We were playing the World Cup in Auckland. We needed to be as tight-knit as we could. And if we announced my retirement, everything became about me. Now, don't get me wrong. I love everything being about me. Since my retirement, I have mercilessly flogged my social life to the magazines, and I've got a really nice pool to show for it. But at the time, the right thing to do was to keep it to myself, to let the team be a great team, but to plan for it meticulously, and that's what we did.
What about that emotional transition, which can be so hard for top-level athletes? What was going to fill all that adrenaline and excitement that sport had filled?
I don't think you can ever fill it adequately. Since becoming a parent, I've discovered that children can fill your days, but I don't know if you get that same level of adrenaline. I did a lot of reading, a lot of talking to different people, and I decided that the physical thing was really important. You'd used your body for so many years that to just cut it off from all the endorphins around training was not a good thing, and that's what I felt probably led some athletes to be to mentally struggle, because physically they had stopped everything. So I decided to get a program where I trained down. So when I finished playing, I didn't just stop training. I actually trained through for the next sort of 8 months, but just gradually decreased my training load. And that really helped me. That still gave me my endorphin hit. It kept me fit, and it kept my mind happy that I was still going on. So I think if you're going to retire, you can't just retire and walk away completely. You're much better off just to taper down. And the other thing we did was we just planned a great holiday to South America, and we went and did the Inca Trail, and we took off for that holiday when all my former teammates and my best friends, the day that they started pre-season. So I thought, right, I'm going to mark this, and we went on this terrific holiday to South America.
Were kids part of your planning with Matthew at this stage? Was that on the cards?
No. We talked about it. Between us, we kept it very very secretive, though. But on the face of it, we basically said we're never having children, because we just didn't want the pressure of people going, oh, you know, you get married, and the first thing is, well, when are you going to have kids? And we had been married for years, and we just fended everyone off by saying, no, we're not having children. But underneath, we talked about that it might be something in the plans.
So when did it become part of the plan? When did things change?
We were in Barcelona drinking sangria, and we had probably indulged a little too much in the sangria, and we had decided that we were going to leave Sydney. We were going to leave Sydney and going, and we were looking to buy a farm up at in the hinterland at Byron Bay. My husband wanted to go back to the land. He came from a farming family and wanted to go back and do that. It was the right time to do it. I'd retired from netball. He'd sold his business. So we thought, yep, let's do that. And then we're like, you know, we're going to need some free labour. Let's have kids.
Because kids are so helpful.
Oh, yeah, they're so... I'm discovering now that it wasn't a great idea. It wasn't a great reason to have kids. But we thought now, if we're going to do it, now's the time. But because we weren't really into the idea, we thought, we'll just try, and if it happens, it happens, and if it doesn't, it doesn't. And 6 weeks after we decided that dinner, we were pregnant. It was like amazing. And you know, Matthew used to say, oh, just be careful, I can knock you up with a thought, you know, like he he was pretty proud of himself that it happened so easily. I'm like, dude, I was there too. So yeah, we were pregnant very quickly, and it was a really easy pregnancy. It never occurred to me that something could go wrong. It was a great birth, and we had our beautiful baby girl.
And how did you adapt to being a mum with Evelyn?
Like any new mum, it blows your mind, doesn't it? This little person comes out, and you fall in love with them straight away. It's instant. I loved breastfeeding. I struggled with the sleep deprivation. I still struggle with sleep deprivation, but. It was a love affair, an instant love affair. And I had it described to me by that by a woman once, and I thought she was nuts. But as soon as my baby appeared, I was like, yep, this is a love affair. I love you.
So did you decide straight away that you wanted to have a second baby?
Immediately. Like, before I left the hospital, I was like, oh, yeah, I want to go again. It's that type A personality. Straight away, I wanted another one. Like that rush of adrenaline and hormones and love that you get, I was like, yep, I want this. And so, we went to see our obstetrician when Evelyn was about 6 weeks old, and he pointed out my advanced age. I was 38 at the time, and he said, you might want to saddle up and go again. And well, yeah, rightio. And we did. And 8 months, when Evelyn was 8 months old, we'd fallen pregnant again really easily. But unfortunately, that was the first of my miscarriages.
You suffered another miscarriage. Tell me about those experiences, because it's not something we talk about.
We don't. And I think, language is ancient, but this, we still don't have the words for this grief. So we had our first miscarriage when Evelyn was 8 months old, and I recovered pretty quickly. I thought, oh, well, I get pregnant pretty easily. Have a couple of months off and we'll go again and we'll be fine. And then 6 months later, nothing had happened. So that was really the start of my engagement with infertility and that infertility industry. So we went to see a specialist, and he put us on fertility drugs, and within 2 months we were pregnant again. And I thought, oh, well, that's all I needed was a bit of help with the ovulation. Things are getting old. We'll be fine. And then again, I miscarried that one. And that was really tough. And then we kept going with the fertility drugs and nothing happened, and we took the decision to move to IVF. And within two cycles, I had fallen pregnant, and I thought, this is it. We saw the baby's heartbeat. And once you see that, you allow hope to flourish. And we had a conversation about names on the way home, and then a few weeks later, we went back. And the worst sentence you can ever hear is, I'm sorry, there's no heartbeat. And my obstetrician did an ultrasound. He couldn't find anything, and he said, look, I'm right on these things, but we'll send you downstairs to the hospital to see. Went downstairs to the hospital, and the radiographer, just seeing pity on her face, she was like, I'm so sorry, there's nothing there. And she left the room, and I just cried and howled into Matthew's shoulder, because I kept saying, there was a baby there last week, there was a baby there. And the little heartbeat had almost been saying to us, sit tight, I'm coming, I'm coming. So it was so sad, and it was so... And that was... I started to beat myself up really badly. You know, we had a... I asked for a biopsy to be done. The problem... that baby had such genetic issues that had it been born, I forget the name of the syndrome, but had it been born, it would have been no life at all for that baby. So, you know, my IVF specialist said to me, it's like your body doing an audit. You know, that little baby, you didn't want to give birth to that baby, and it was a little boy. And so that was hard. When you find out the gender, it's hard, because you start like it's a person. Anyway, so he didn't last, but the grief certainly did, and the grief was overwhelming.
And the thing with a miscarriage is, particularly if it happens before you're showing, before the rest of the world realises you're pregnant, it's so isolating, it's so alone. You have to make the choice to talk to people about it or not. And as you said, there's not really a language that we have for this grief. Did you tell other people about your miscarriages? Did you talk about them?
Not really. I told my family, obviously, because they knew that I was pregnant. And when I had my third miscarriage, actually, my best friend, Kath Cox, who was in the Australian netball team at the time, was at our house visiting, and we had got her to look after Evelyn when we went for the ultrasound. And Matthew had to ring her and tell her what happened. Then I had to go back the next day for a D&C. And she didn't know what to say. So, you know, she knew, my family knew, but nobody else knew. It's so such a we treat it so personally and privately, and there are no words. What do you say to someone? You know, someone's father passes away. There are words for that. I'm sorry for your loss and that sort of thing. But miscarriage is different. There's not a lot of words for it. And because I didn't tell a lot of people. For so many weeks and months afterwards, I beat myself up. You know, I chastised myself for waiting till we were so old to start a family. You know, it's not like I had met my husband late in life. We met when I was 20. I had my sperm donor right there all this time. But he had to keep reminding me, Matthew kept reminding me that, you know, we'd made our choices. Our choices were to focus on his career and my netball, and I'd won World Cups. But through that time, I would have handed back every single World Cup and every single gold medal for another baby, because I thought, this isn't going to happen.
Mm.
This is Conversations with Sarah Kanofsky on ABC Radio.
I wonder also with you, Liz, because your body, you were so used to your body succeeding and doing what you wanted it to and pushing it to achieve things. Did it make you think about your own body differently?
Yeah, I was angry. I was really angry with my body, because for all those years it had responded to everything that I'd asked it to do. You know, I wanted it to get fitter, so I ran and I was fitter, and I wanted to be stronger, so I lifted weights and I was stronger, and, you know, I wanted to hurt goal shooters, so I elbowed them and it hurt them. So, you know, not really. Okay, I did. So, you know, all these years I'd been asking for more and more from my body, and it had delivered. And even when I was injured, it used to respond. It would respond to the treatment or that sort of thing. So suddenly to have your body not responding, to not do what it should do, it made me so angry and so frustrated. And the response for me when I was playing netball and when I was an athlete, when something didn't work, you doubled down, you worked harder, you trained harder, and you cut out this and you focused on that. But that doesn't work with fertility. You can't punish your body. You can't work it harder and train harder with fertility. You have to be much kinder to yourself. And I had to learn to do that.
Well, this is you talking about the qualities that you brought to your on-court game. You need to be determined, prepared to go hard all day and wear someone down, to make someone's life difficult. You've got to be annoying and have a bit of mongrel, not like the lipstick-wearing girls who shoot. So
it's true.
So these qualities, did they almost hinder you in this journey towards fertility?
Yeah, they did. And, you know, as a goalkeeper, I had to wear people down. That was my game plan, to chase them and tag them all day. That's got nothing to do with fertility. That doesn't help. You know, I didn't want to wear some poor little egg down until it did as I told it to do. So all the things that I had learned through my athletic career, I almost had to unlearn. I had to learn to be kinder to my body, to let things take its course, and to learn to be patient.
Because you had been able to conceive with your daughter, and then even, I suppose, with the miscarriages, were you labelled infertile? Mm. What did it mean?
The diagnosis was secondary infertility. When you have your diagnosis, you're either diagnosed with primary or secondary. Primary is you have never been able to fall pregnant or carry a pregnancy through to having a baby. Secondary infertility is when you've fallen pregnant, you've had a baby, but you're not able to do it the second time round. For me, that was frustrating, because not only were we do we have secondary infertility, it was also unexplained infertility. There's no diagnosis, really. It's just a big fat "I don't really know" from the doctors, because you have all the tests, everything comes back normal. The fact that you've been able to conceive on a number of occasions and to carry a pregnancy through once means that everything seems to be in pretty good working order. And that's where, you know, up to 20% of couples land.
Did the fact that you already had a healthy baby, did that lead some doctors, maybe some friends, to say, you know, don't worry about the second one, you've got your baby, what are you after?
Oh, no one actually gave us, or no one said that to us. But after 5 rounds and 4 years, we started to say that to ourselves. You know, we realised that we had started to focus on a baby that we didn't have, and lose focus on the gorgeous little girl that we did have. And we had to leave her with mum or with friends to look after her while we went off to get treatment. And I didn't like doing that. I was missing out on time with her. So after five rounds, the last two rounds we did, we, because of the last miscarriage, we decided to get as many embryos as we could and get them tested, genetically tested, before you implant them. And I got, there were four embryos, I got four phone calls, each one saying, I'm really sorry, they're incompatible with life, we're going to now let them succumb, which is a really nice way of saying we're going to take them out of the freezer and put them on the bench top. And it's an awful, it's just another little uppercut, you know, in the journey. And we got to the point and we said, let's just stop. And then a few weeks later, my sister rang and said, why don't you do one more round of IVF and let me be the egg donor? And I was like, oh, that's a good idea. Our kids look like each other. Her little girl acts like me, looks like me, loves books, loves netball. My little girl is horrible in the mornings like her, you know, like...
Notice that you've got all the good qualities.
I know. This is my interview, Sarah. If you want her story, you can interview her. But, you know, our kids look like each other. We're really close. You know, when we moved to the farm, one of the reasons we did it was because her and her family lived in Ballina in northern New South Wales. We wanted to be near her. So she said, let me do a donor cycle for you, which... she did, and we wanted to do. So we went through all of the genetic testing and the counselling. You have to have counselling as an individual, as a couple, as a foursome, and we did the whole lot and spent a fortune. And then we're waiting for day one of my cycle so that we could get going. And she rang me one day. She goes, when's day one? Oh, I don't know. I've had so many cycles, I don't know. Anyway, about a week later, she said, you need to go and do a pregnancy test. And it hadn't occurred to me that I might be pregnant. And I did a pregnancy test, and sure enough, there were two pink lines, and Austin had shown his face the old-fashioned way.
And so that was not through IVF, not through any other intervention, just he just happened.
Well, I mean, there was something.
Couldn't Matthew still just look at you? Wasn't that the...
Actually, we told my mum when a few weeks later that we were pregnant, and she said to me, oh, by yourself? Matthew said, no, Margaret, I was there. So, you know, but it was the old-fashioned way. And
so is that proof of that old adage, if you just relax, it will all happen?
Yes, which is horrible. I hate it because mum had spent so many hours while we were going through infertility telling me these stories. Oh, you know, so-and-so was telling me today, I was at the St. Vincent de Paul and at the meeting, they were saying that, you know, their daughter tried for years and then she gave up and then now she's got three kids. So the whole thing was about, like, you know, relaxing and that sort of stuff. And eventually I sat her down with a cup of tea and said, Mum, I just don't need these stories. I don't need stories of hope. I don't need that. I actually just need for you to be with me. And I can't be, you can't tell me to stop trying, because that is the antithesis of everything I have achieved in my life, to stop trying. So then, of course, when I told her that we're pregnant, she was like, I told you so. So now I'm one of those bloody stories.
Given that you had your first child so easily and then your second child took so much effort and heartache and time, do you parent him differently, do you think, than you do Evelyn?
I parent both of them a little bit differently than when we, you know, we just had Evelyn. I think the whole infertility journey has taught me patience. You know, I used to, if Evelyn woke up in the middle of the night, I'd be like, oh. Whereas now it's like, well, it's an opportunity to sneak a cuddle when they wake up. And you're far more, you really do cherish them, because, not that I didn't before, but you know, when you have so much trouble to fall pregnant and then to get your baby, you know, when he wakes up in the middle of the night and wants something, you know, I'm like, well, you know, you're not going to be this little for very long.
So your story, Liz, ended happily, which is wonderful. Why did you decide to write a book about infertility?
I guess I got to the end of our journey, for want of a better word. And I had all these folders of information, and I had all these thoughts about what we'd been through and what I wish I knew at the start that I knew at the end. And the thing that I hated about the whole thing was that when I was an athlete, I used to love getting my yearly program, and it would have the competition dates and it would have all the things, you know, our training periodisation and how that would work. And I loved putting it in my diary and seeing how everything would work. But suddenly in infertility, there's no roadmap. You are going blind in a snowstorm. There is nothing. And when I was at the end of that, looking back, I could see that actually there is a roadmap. There is certain things that should point you on your way. And I thought to myself, it would be stupid to just carry this information around and do nothing with it. I would like to pass on what I learned to somebody else, and the best way to do that is through a book. When I was looking for resources, when I was in the middle of it, I found it really difficult because you do a search online and you only have to Google infertility and you get 63 million search results, which is overwhelming, the amount of information, but there's no way to sift through it what's relevant and what's not, especially when you're in the middle of it, when you're grasping at everything and you want to make sure that you don't miss anything. So I thought, I'm at the end of it now, I can approach it with a bit of objectivity. So I started to do some research and I felt that there was a book in it.
And how did you round up other people to tell you their stories as well? Because that's a big part of the book.
Well, I bullied my friends and family to start with. Like, I knew a lot of my girlfriends. There's plenty of netballers in the book and I knew their stories. So I just wrote their stories up and then sent them a release form. But then I put a call out on social media and said, if you have an infertility story, if you've been treated, I'd love to hear from you. And people who I didn't know got in contact with me from all over Australia with the most amazing stories.
From all the research that you did, does it tend to be more a male or a female problem, infertility?
It's pretty equal. It so often gets discussed as a female problem, and or it's a female issue, it's a women's thing. Whereas the stats pretty clearly tell you that in about 30% of the cases, it's female factor infertility. In about 30% of the cases, it's male factor infertility. And in about 40% of the cases, it's a bit of both. It's subfertility in both couples leading to infertility. That's not widely known. I was shocked when I discovered that. And the sooner we have this conversation about the fact that it's no one's fault, but there are issues equally in women and men, the sooner you take away the stigma around infertility for men.
There's a big narrative that it's women's fault because women are waiting too long to start to try to have children. Is that borne out by what you discovered?
No, I mean, the longer you wait, the harder it is. But, you know, the narrative is that, oh, if you wait to have kids until your late 30s, early 40s, you won't fall pregnant unless it's through IVF or something like that. But you go and look at the Australian Bureau of Statistics, and I think for the last year that there were statistics available, 2015, there was something like 26,000 women over the age of 35 or 46. I'm not good at numbers. 46,000 women over the age of 35 had kids that year, and 3,000 of them were through assisted reproductive technology. So you can still do it. It can still happen. But so the narrative, I think, needs to change to talking about this is what can affect your fertility. If you wait until you are older and you're a woman, it might take you longer. It may not happen at all. But if for men, there is also, you know, plenty to think about as well.
Do you think the stigma of infertility is different for men and for women?
Very much so. I spoke to people, obviously, women and men who were diagnosed as infertile, and they all felt it really impacted their sense of self. But I think with men it's almost visceral. When they get told they're infertile, it really threatens their masculinity. Whereas, you know, it's just one of those things. And technology is so good now that if it is male factor fertility, it's highly likely that there's a way around it. And if not, I've got some stories of some men who they've had families with their partners using donor sperm. And to a man, they said, when the baby came out, that baby was mine.
For couples who are going through assisted reproduction, there are challenges, different challenges for each. For women, there's needles. There's a lot of description about the number of needles that people on IVF endure. For men, it tends to be more sample jars in small locked rooms. Tell me about the guy that you chatted to at a dinner party who got the sample request wrong.
So I was at a dinner party and I was saying that I was writing this book, and he sidled up to me and he said, I don't want to tell you this in front of everyone, but we were going through fertility treatment and I had to go to the clinic, and I had been speaking to my mates about it, and they were basically saying to me, it's tops to have to give a sperm sample because you get to have a state-sanctioned wank, right? You get to go, there's like a couch, there's some porn, sometimes there's light beer, it's really cool. So he was sort of looking forward to this visit to the clinic, and they went to the doctor and they go to the clinic, and the nurse hands him a specimen jar and says, if you just go down there, and he walks into what he thinks is going to be this, you know, awesome room, and it's a toilet cubicle.
So sad that that's the awesome room, that it's some light beer and porn. And
look, men are simple creatures, let's face it. So he goes into this room and, not wanting to let the team down, he comes out with a sperm sample and hands it to the nurse, and the nurse looks at him and goes, I wanted a urine sample. So it's good to communicate, is the takeout from that.
Well, in terms of communication, if a couple have decided they do need to go and get help or talk to a doctor, what kind of conversation do you think they need to have with one another before they go to the doctor?
Yeah, so around infertility, I think the thought is, and the way that I guess we've been marketed to, is that you try to have a baby naturally, and if you can't fall pregnant within a few months, then the next thing you do is get a referral to an IVF clinic. You actually need to have a lot of conversations with your partner and with your GP before you get to that point. So, you know, talking to GPs, they find it much easier to deal with couples, especially when they come in, when they're prepared to be open and honest and they don't feel like they've got to make stupid jokes to break the tension. You know, GPs have seen it all before. And they've heard everything before. But you need to talk about things like any previous pregnancies that you've been involved in that didn't involve your partner, any previous sexually transmitted diseases or anything like that that you might have had, because you don't want to be disclosing them in front of your partner in a doctor's surgery for the first time. But this is the stuff you don't know. And so when we got to the end of the journey, I thought, I need to put this in a book so that people can be forewarned, you know. And then if you do go to your GP, understand that there's such a big jump from not being able to conceive naturally to IVF. It should be the treatment of last resort, whereas in our brains, I think we think of it as the next resort, that's the next thing you do. There's so much that you can do, that you can address things that don't cost anything, like lifestyle and diet. You can make sure that you are in the best possible shape and give your body a chance to fall pregnant. For example, if you're overweight or obese, you only need to lose 10% of your body weight to massively increase your chances of falling pregnant. And what that does is, if you do fall pregnant, it lays a great groundwork for far more healthier pregnancy and delivery of your baby. And it also means if you go to IVF, you're more likely to be pregnant. And there's so much research around now that if you smoke, if your partner smokes, then there's a greater incidence of childhood cancers in children born to that partnership. So, you know, the first thing you need to do is actually clean up your act and get healthy, and then think about what treatment to get before you get to IVF.
But fertility is such a huge business. How expensive is it to get IVF in Australia?
There's a massive range of expenses. So there's clinics that bulk bill, and there's still a cost because there's some things that Medicare doesn't cover. One of the great hacks that I got told by a highly respected fertility doctor was to go to a fertility doctor that works for an IVF clinic that is associated with the bulk billing clinic, and there's a few of them, and ask them if the protocol of the bulk billing clinic would be appropriate for you. That'll save you thousands. I guess a run-of-the-mill clinic, it can set you back $8,000 to $10,000 up front for each cycle, and you get roughly half of that back through Medicare. Then there's boutique clinics that might work solely with older women, or you know, women who have endometriosis, or men who have had testicular cancer or something, and that they can be really expensive. That can be $15,000, and you only get $4,000 or $5,000 back. So it's an incredibly expensive. And I try not to be critical of the people involved, because yes, it's expensive, but there are some people in those clinics who are incredibly passionate, and I met them. But then I also heard horrific stories of people being treated like a sausage factory, like a production line. The biggest takeout I want people to have is that you own your own treatment. Be responsible for your own treatment. These doctors are treating 10, sometimes hundreds of people. Be your best advocate.
That's the whole financial element of the cost of infertility. What about the emotional cost on couples? Like, how did it affect your marriage?
Yeah, it's a huge amount of pressure, because financial pressure can lead to emotional pressure. But there's pressure around little things like you have these injections when you go through the stimulations component. You're getting injected every day, not with one needle. I was having three needles a day. That's hard. The first time you do it, to actually pierce your skin with a needle is it's hard yakka. And then, you know, inevitably, if you had a white T-shirt on, it would bleed. because then it would bleed through your shirt, which is good preparation for motherhood. You just don't wear white. But emotionally, it's tough because you're on this huge emotional roller coaster when you're on this stimulation cycle. All your hormones are being stimulated. You almost feel a little bit out of control. Some women don't, some women do. For men that I spoke to, they felt like, especially if they were the ones that were infertile, that to see their partners have to go through this needle hurricane because of them, they found it really difficult. But what I found speaking to people and thinking about our relationship, mine and Matthew's relationship, was fertility treatment and IVF in particular exacerbates what is already there. For us, we've got a really strong marriage. It probably reminded us of that we needed to communicate a bit better, but it made us stronger. We got through it, we were stronger at the end. A friend of mine loaned me her diary, which was amazing, that when she went through treatment, and she talked about the fact that the things that she loved about her husband, she saw so much more of because he took care of her through it. But then I spoke to two women whose marriages had broken down through the IVF process, and they both said that there was cracks and the IVF was like watering cracks and just split them apart. So I think if there's issues in your relationship, you need to deal with them before you go anywhere near fertility treatment.
It's wonderful when this story ends well and when people who want to have a baby manage to have one. But of course, that doesn't always happen. What did you hear about the decision to say, we're going to stop trying, we accept it's not going to happen?
It's a really difficult decision, and I would encourage anyone who's about to step into that treatment for fertility or for infertility to think about, to almost make a decision before you start about when you will end it. Do you have an amount of money that you're prepared to spend, or is there a time period? Because the problem is it can go and go and go, and you find yourself living in 2-week blocks. But then you speak to people who have made the decision to finish. And for some people, it's because the money ran out. For some people, they hit their 43rd birthday or whatever, the decision was made. And if you don't have your much longed for baby at the end of it, it can be such a difficult decision to make. But one woman in particular who I spoke to, who was just amazing, she was such an inspiration. She had decided to discontinue. She said that when they decided to do their last round, she got the phone call to say, I'm sorry, but nothing, you're not pregnant. And she felt numb for the first few days. But then she had to go through a process of addressing this sense of emptiness. So her sister had decided to remain childless. Her sister decided not to have kids, and she spent a lot of time with her. And she said the best thing you can do is to find someone who has consciously made that decision, because they will almost mentor you through this process. So she sent a beautiful email, which she's given me permission to reproduce in the book, telling her friends and family what had happened, what had transpired, asking them not to give her any advice, because you don't want advice, not to give pity, but to just be and to be with them. And it's an email that's so full of love, but also it tells people how to act. And people around you, they love you, but they don't know what to do. So that's the first thing you have to deal with. The second thing is, and this woman had done this, she was in the process of doing it, of figuring out what her life looked like without a child. And there are a number of men and women who've had to do that. And if you think of children, the thing that is overwhelming is this sense of legacy. They are your legacy. They are what you leave. So she was working on what her legacy would be. She had decided to work with a charity that worked with animals, and that was going to be her legacy. She felt that she needed to show herself more than anything else that you don't need to have a child to be a successful woman. You don't need to have a child to be a successful man. But the other thing is, and this was the hard thing for her, was that you don't want to cut yourself off from your friends with children. You know, you get to be the fun auntie who buys lollies and who hands the children back to the parents at the end of the day. And so there's so much to be gained out of those sort of relationships. And she was really working on cultivating those to make sure that she still had the love of children in her life.
All this time talking to people who had undergone infertility, your own experiences with it, what's it left you knowing about things that maybe you didn't know before you went through this?
When I sat back and reflected, it's a love story. You know, the human heart is capable of the most amazing things. And, you know, I would spend nights talking to the most amazing people who had been through so much, yet still came out of it loving their partner, loving themselves, loving the family that they had created in whatever way, shape or form. I would be sitting at my computer at night talking to people, bawling my eyes out because the story, the life experience that people were prepared to tell me was amazing. And they wanted to tell their story, not so much that they wanted their story heard, but they wanted their story to light the way for somebody else. And it's such a beautiful thing to give your story to make somebody else's journey easier. Speaking to people who had created not the family that they thought they'd have, but they had overcome obstacles to create a family. You know, I spoke to one woman who had done 19 IVF cycles. Extraordinary. On her 12th cycle, she fell pregnant with twins, and she miscarried them at 20 weeks and had to deliver them. And the story that she told me about her husband holding those babies, it is heartbreaking. But then she went on to have her sons and her life is so happy. So the desire to create a family, to have a baby, is such a primal thing. When you see what people will do to be able to love somebody else, it's an amazing, amazing thing. I feel very privileged to have had those stories entrusted to me.
You live up in the country now. Do you play netball at all anymore?
No, my knees wouldn't cope. I play old ladies tennis, which I love, and I've got an excellent backhand. I think it's excellent. It finds a net a bit. I do that. I play tennis. I do Pilates. I play with my kids. I garden.
Do you think delinquency is still a danger for you without the team sports?
I don't think so. I'm too much of a goody two-shoes, but I will say that I am so grateful to netball for everything it has given to me. You know, I've got my life that I've got now because I could pass and catch, and I'm so grateful.
Liz Ellis, thank you so much for sharing your story.
Thank you. Thanks, Sarah. Thank you.
On ABC Radio, this is Conversations with Sarah Kanofsky.
You've been listening to my conversation with Liz Ellis. Her book is called If at First You Don't Conceive. abc.net.au/conversations is our website. I'm Sarah Kanofsky. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Sarah Kanofsky. For more Conversations interviews, head to the website abc.net.au/conversations.